All right, so welcome to another T-Rex Talk. This one is going to be good. I can already tell because I'm not alone in the room. I have with me two gentlemen from redbeardtactical.de, and you guys have secret identities, I believe, but what name shall you go by in this conversation?
Felix.
All right, Felix, welcome to the talk, and then...
Sasha,
it's great to have you here, and it's great to have you in person. We've already had a whole bunch of really fascinating off-the-record conversations, and I predict that while we're recording, we will cover some off-the-record stuff and have to edit it out.
We will see.
We will see. But let's begin by talking about some relatively easy stuff, some soft skills, some hard skills. What are some really important things? As you watch the tactical community here in the United States tends to jump from one thing to the other really quickly. So it's all about shooting. Then it's all about CQB. Then it's all about recce rifles, even though there's no definition of what that is. Then suddenly it's all about sustainment. What's the next thing that we're going to jump to and forget everything else that we've ever learned?
I don't know. It's unpredictable, but it may be even parachuting or something like that.
Yes.
But I think all skills are important. All skills are equally important, and there should be an awareness of that taking one skill to an absolute will completely destroy your economy of training. So yes. I personally see and read in my private messages that a lot of people say like, oh, CQB doesn't matter, shooting doesn't matter, you need to sustain. But if you're in a tactical community, why sustain for sustainment's sake? If you want to go to the fight, you need also to win the fight. Don't forget about it.
Yeah, so this is a very important topic, how you balance out all these different aspects, all these different skills. It's very easy to focus on the equipment because attaining equipment is easy if you have the funds. Learning how to use the equipment is very different, and learning how to use those soft skills are really difficult. So let's say you're talking to somebody like me who has the ability to acquire equipment, very little time. If I had to pick a small subset of things to start with and build upon, what should I start with?
Of course, you should start with a rifle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a rifle, a pistol. But when it comes to the kit, nylon kit and sustainment kit side, I personally think there's no way around a rug. There's no way around a chest rig or any other kind of load-bearing equipment. And another thing, bottles. You need water, you need protection, you need food. Yeah.
And balance out all these things, the sustainment and the fighting together.
Yeah, balancing it. Going to balance this all is the really hard part. I think many people make a science out of it. Mm-hmm. So when we went to the States now, we had to pack, considering that we will fly on a plane. So we still brought our sustainment kit with us and our fighting kit with us and our assault kit with us, and... what we brought is pretty minimalist, but will sustain us in the woods of Tennessee for a pretty long time.
Okay.
So, water. You need to be aware of the fact that you don't only need, that the ability to purify water does not replace your ability to carry water. So,
yes.
6 liters a day should be carried with you. So, 6 liters equals 6 Nalgene's or something like that. And honestly, in the military, I've never really filtered water during an exercise that didn't have the goal of teaching how to filter water.
Right.
And the same goes for deployment. I never have filtered water during a deployment. I'm sure there are people that did it, but it's not common.
Yeah.
You have to carry that load. And I think the backpack is a good symbol because there are many people that try to go around the backpack like they're getting a belt kit and say, oh, I don't need a backpack right now. Yeah, no, a backpack is heavy, but you need it. 6 liters of water are 6 kilo. You don't want to carry those 6 kilos plus your fighting kit in your belt kit.
Yeah, there are basics and there are extras. Yeah, so the basics are always the same. The basics are those which work for the most armies, and the basics are always works with the most environments. Mm-hmm. And the extras are applied for whatever task you are assigned to.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that is interesting, so not only do you need to carry this equipment and the sustainment gear with you, but you're talking about moving distance. And so movement and knowing where to move.
Yeah.
Is a logical extension of this.
Yeah. Lentness is a very, and the ability to march long distance is a very big issue in the tactical community right now. As you may know, we do quizzes on Lentnav and other topics. And so far, Lentnav was the topic where most people had really difficulties in doing it. And people had been really reflective and said, like, I need to learn Lentnav at some certain point. And it's the good thing about Lentnav is that it's a hard skill. So you can prove that you're either right or wrong. It's not like tactics where we can discuss all day. If you go to the wrong destination, I can say you're wrong. I give you another destination. We can discuss about it.
Yeah.
We can discuss about the whys, but we can't discuss about the outcome.
Yeah. Well, I was also going to say, you can also scroll back through your quizzes and you can see how many I have failed on Instagram.
So yeah.
How often do you check my answers?
I actually don't have the time to check for individual answers, but sometimes I look at certain answers because some really stand out when we have like four options and one option is completely wrong. It's pretty interesting to see that. But I respect everyone who's participating because when we have like 5,000 viewers of a story, only about 1,000 participate.
Okay, so, interesting.
So do it. Just check your skills.
Yeah, no, definitely. Everybody listening, check your skills. Apparently, you don't check unless we said something really hilariously wrong. Then it's worth looking. I know I've done that a couple of times. I know that I've picked an option that later like 7 people picked. So embarrassing, but useful for learning. So in the United States, we have Boy Scouts of America, which used to teach orienteering. There still is orienteering as a general hobby. But how does that differ from military land navigation? Is there anything that is really specifically different in a military perspective?
No, not really.
It's just the outside.
Because it's a hard skill. It's like shooting.
Yeah.
If you're shooting USPSA, IPSC, it's not a big difference from military shooting or not any difference at all. So it's the same with hard skills. So basically, what I think what most people don't like about Lentnav or why they don't get there is they are afraid of it. They're simply afraid of it because they think it's really hard to learn, but it isn't. It just requires a lot of common sense. Really, it's just about doing it.
Yeah. And it's really easy to learn these days because you can have your phone in your pocket. So you can't actually get lost. You just don't cheat by looking at your phone.
Yeah, and you can even double check. It's really great. I do it myself when I repeat some skills or something. I double check on my phone. So I get a double confirmation. I'm there. Okay. I know I'm there, but I can also check on my phone. Is it the same? Is it the same location? It's not bad to use technology for training. And it's also not bad to use technology doing the actual thing.
So we have a friend of ours is a Green Beret and he tried out for Delta. And it was very interesting because this issue of testing comes up when you're trying out for a new requirement or new deployment or new unit. But he was very surprised at what Delta was testing for. Obviously, they are trying to find the cream of the crop, so they weren't trying to find out if he could do LNF. He's already a Green Beret. But there were some very specific things that they were looking for in his testing, and it wasn't what he expected. It was not objectives that were hard to find. It was some of the obstacles in the middle, and they just wanted to see how are they going to react to some of those obstacles. So there's a lot more to it than just point A to point B on a map, but point A to point B on a map is the prerequisite. It's the prerequisite.
You need to find your objective on the map. You need to find where you are on the map. And like you stated, connecting those two dots, unless you are in the desert, wouldn't work. Yeah, that's the point. Unless you're in a really plain desert, you have obstacles. And I think the most important thing about Lentnav is terrain association. Really getting that image from the map into your brain and translating it to the landscape around you.
I've been thinking about that a lot based on a project that we'll talk about later.
So generally, keep balanced about all those things. Don't make sustainment or Lentnav the new CQB. Don't overfocus this. It's not a science. You can learn it pretty easy. That's the good thing about it.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm always trying to talk about economy of training and making your training economic. So if you go, for example, a good example are knots. You have some basic knots, three basic knots you need in the field, yeah, which is the regular knot, the square knot, and the adjustable tortage. And those three knots can do most of the work for you. You can do 5 minutes of practicing those every day. You can do 15 minutes of dry firing every day. So keep all economic. Just go out with a map, or try to associate the terrain with a map of your area when you're simply out there.
And not only about that, it's also about your physical. Get fit, train. Like Grand Thumb stated always, if you're not fit, you die.
Yeah.
And we don't. That's also an important thing, because a lot of the time, I think people get scared when it comes to fitness because of certain individuals that think the only way to remain fit is to doing some really, really heavy CrossFit workout that are really only feasible for genetic exceptions or people that are taking roids. So people should more go into do a run every second day or every third day. Do your 50 to 200 push-ups every morning. You don't need to do them in succession if you don't manage to, but you're fitter than 95% of society.
If you have a daily routine, you won't miss it because your body is calling for that routine.
Yes.
And you want to run, you want to lift weights, you want to make push-ups and so on and so forth.
Yeah. Or make it a habit, but don't go into the really fancy stuff.
Yeah. Well, you're also one of the genetic exceptions, so it has to be stated.
No, it's just roids.
This is something that you've talked about quite a bit on your Instagram channel. And I appreciate it because I know a lot of U.S. veterans that have spent a lot of time on the global war on terror. But even your perspective that both of you bring to your Instagram channel, even though you have fought in Afghanistan and been to a lot of these similar places, the German military has gone about them in different ways with different doctrine, different level of support. So I think it's just really fascinating to see some of the perspective that you guys bring. But I'm also seeing that entirely as an outsider. What are some of the ways that you would characterize those differences as how Germany would do things in Afghanistan versus, say, the United States? You want to get very political or very basic.
The German armed forces are not used to deploy as an actual fighting force. They are deployed as a peacekeeping force, like in Balkan conflicts, Kosovo, Serbia, and something like that. And this is what Afghanistan changed the Bundeswehr, changed the German army. The German army was forced to conduct offensive operations, to conduct delay operations, to conduct everything which is related to a combat operation, and also to getting used to have casualties, either wounded, dead, fallen, whatever. Yeah, this is what Afghanistan has changed the Bundeswehr very much, and in a certain perspective, the Bundeswehr is conducting the same failures which they did in Afghanistan in the first one, again in Africa, again and again and again. And this is what the Bundeswehr is very lacking about it, the lesson learned. Yeah, we are always delaying on our lesson learned about at least 15 years.
That sounds about right for all the military history I've studied.
Yeah.
15 years is a
pretty
good response baseline for military, state militaries.
We have to look at the fact that the German, as Knopfi stated, the German military has had many firsts during Afghanistan. So in my first combat deployment, it was a lot of firsts that vehicles engineered for the Cold War, like the Marder IFV, have seen their first use in combat. I actually participated in the first attack conducted by German forces since World War II. That's a lot of time.
Yeah.
That's a lot of time. And I didn't realize it back then. I read it in the newspapers. Oh, yeah, that's real. Got me pretty interested in why things are like this. And we also had to test out a lot of new stuff, and we realized that some stuff didn't work in the desert, for example, like the ammunition for howitzers didn't work the first time.
Right.
Yeah.
And then, since there's now this 15-year lag, everybody's looking at Ukraine.
Yeah.
Everybody's considering a completely different type of engagement environment, everything. And so 15 years from now, they'll be ready for fighting the Russians in Ukraine.
Yeah. And we will have a new Afghanistan or something along those lines. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. I believe that governments have also changed their priorities a little bit. After World War II, this idea of fighting near peer wars kind of faded away. It faded away during Korea and Vietnam, and then definitely after Vietnam, to the point where I lived in New Zealand at the time when they sold their Air Force. They had Skyhawks that needed to be replaced, but they didn't replace them with interceptor aircraft, which is a great thing to have if you were an island. Yeah. If you're an island nation, interceptor aircraft are extremely useful. They replaced them with Strykers, and they picked the largest Stryker, the LAV-3 Stryker, that doesn't fit into a C-130. We were talking about this yesterday.
Yeah.
So they ended up with a peacekeeping force that was really hard to move anywhere except their own country. So the focus that some of these nations have and the way that they see conflict, potential conflict, their responsibilities, their duties, even the way they see their own citizens kind of changes over the last several decades. And you can see them making those decisions even in what they purchase. But then a new conflict comes along. You see that the Russian bear is still prowling about. And everybody kind of loses their minds from him and runs around and changes policy drastically.
I think force always needs a utility to be justified.
Yeah.
That's a really important point. And many nations have seeked for a utility. And like the scenario that you described on this island nation is really self-explaining. Yeah. Where they can be used, it's on domestic ground.
Yep.
Yeah. And the government decided that that's the utility of force, why they should have enforce anymore. And now stuff changes and the world isn't the same peaceful place in majority as it was before. We had those very clean lines between the Mideast, basically, and the Hindu Kush, where we had war, and we had the rest of the world, Western world, like we like to call us, no matter where we are located, that was essentially peaceful. Mm-hmm. And Ukraine changed a lot of this.
Yes. And it kind of also, I think, goes back to you develop a lot of presuppositions, a lot of things that you assume to be true because they were true at one time. Yeah. So when I was very small, everyone was preparing for a Cold War with the Soviet Union. NATO was built for the purpose of uniting a bunch of little countries to fight a great big empire.
Yeah.
And that affected the entire world. So New Zealand never saw itself as having a complete military capability. It always saw itself as being an ally to a larger coalition force. And I think that this idea came about in the 80s that we're going to fight world wars from here on out. So if you're too small to fight a world war, if you're New Zealand, you can't fight a world war. You can just provide a few battalions to someone else who's fighting a world war. And you don't actually think about the fact that New Zealand is an island nation, very isolated, has a lot of resources, has mountains, has fresh water, has tremendous defensive capability. New Zealand has the ability to defend itself and make it very, very, very expensive to invade. But you fight a couple of world wars, this assumption kind of sets in that this is the way that states need to operate.
Yeah, and there's no more threat from the outside. That's the next.
Right. Yeah.
That's the next conclusion that many governments have made. Yes. So the force needed a new utility.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's interesting the way that this develops. Clausewitz talks about politics and war.
Yeah. It's basically often stated wrong that war is a continuation of politics. But what many people skip is that he also stated that politics should always run alongside war. That's the point.
Yeah.
But of course, at some point, violence and therefore war is always an institutional thing, will be the longer arm of politics.
Yeah.
And it's also the reason they are there. The force they utilize is the reason why politicians are in power or why governments are in power.
Yeah. And then those politicians will make decisions, things like replace our defensive capability with a stronger policing capability. These are political decisions that have war adjacent consequences.
Yeah, that's a very big point. And it's also the thing about, are we talking about an army now Or are we talking about a big paramilitary policing force?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the big question, because in Germany we had the same thing in the dark chapters of our history.
Mm-hmm. In the United States, obviously we have founding documents that haven't been changed too much, but we have an entire legal code that very clearly separates law enforcement from military. But we've also seen very recently that if there is an emergency, people will sign new emergency powers documents. People will change things, and things can change very quickly. So I think it is really important that people on the ground really be paying attention to these things and not just make the assumption that major changes don't happen in their lifetimes. Yeah. Major changes always happen in history. They never happen in the future.
Laws are not natural. They have been written, so everyone can rewrite them.
Yes.
It's a piece of paper at the end of the day.
Laws are invited with the purpose of someone.
Yes. It's good to pay attention to these sorts of things. We're right on the edge of getting to something that we would have to cut out. I can feel it in there. But understanding some of these bigger issues, I believe, are really as important as land nav, fresh water. Having an idea of what's going on and what caused it, I think, is really, really important. I think that everybody knows that we are at perhaps not a major pivot point, but this is an interesting time to be alive.
And multi-aspect changes. First, because of the war in the Ukraine.
Yep.
Now, this is not really affecting in a direct way the U.S., mm-hmm. but it's affecting the allies of the U.S.
Yes.
The allies of the U.S. and in the EU, or in Europe as a whole, they are protecting the eastern border now. So the U.S. are free to move their forces in a different way. Yeah. And for you, I don't know too much about the changing the laws, but I think you have the really big issue between the pros and the cons for that law.
Private gun ownership is a major factor everything from geopolitics to how safe my family is at home and inside our own four walls. So quickly, as soon as the Ukrainian government started handing out rifles to their citizens, well, first of all, it was late because the invasion had already begun.
Right. Oh, yes.
No time for training, but still better than nothing.
Yeah.
And everybody in America said, hooray, the people will resist the invaders.
Yeah.
But now, just a few months later, so many people in America are saying, you would never need an AR-15. Under what circumstances would you ever need an AR-15? You should hand it back into the government.
it's partly because the war in Ukraine became something of daily life. It's also not in first place in the news.
Become normal.
At all the time, and you're getting used to it.
It's a fast news cycle. Once something has been in the news for a month, it's boring. And do you have a prediction for what's going to happen in Ukraine?
We have at least I have a very rough prediction. I think Russia will, as always, or as they have done before, retract some of their initial goals, which they already did. They will retract them more. Right now, they have the manpower to gain some more territory, but I think they will not gain more as they already have. So they will retract those goals. And what they fear is an Ukrainian counterattack supported by Western technology. That's a thing.
So they will potentially pull back and offer a benevolent compromise.
Oh, yeah.
Just like the socialists in this country are doing in our legislature.
Yeah.
We won't take all your guns.
Yeah.
What a nice compromise.
Just a few.
Yes.
Just a very dangerous guns.
Yes. Yeah.
Russia tried to run a low cost war now. You can see it clearly to pull out the modern weapons they use and put in the older T-62 weapons to minimize the cost now. And to use the foreign, let's say, mercenaries, the Chechen, the Syrians, and whatever.
Is there... do you think that's just a mere cost-cutting measure, or do you think they want to just have those things in reserve for
It's both. Because if they're running in an insurgency war, guerrilla war, they guerrilla wars are expensive.
Yeah.
And at usually the attacker in a guerrilla war failed.
Russia experienced that already. They experienced two Chechen wars. They experienced the fighting in Afghanistan about 10 years, and they failed.
Yeah.
And even in 2008, it was the case they almost failed because the Georgians closed the two tunnels for the Russians, and the Russians just called the Georgian government and threatened them, if you don't open the tunnel, we bomb Tiflis. No matter civilians or military goals. Yeah.
The advantage of a guerrilla force against a conventional force is that the conventional force always fights an industrial war, meaning they will utilize their industrial capabilities, their financial capabilities, their population's capabilities, while the guerrilla force is fighting a people's war. They have a very low cost, very low effort, and can disperse whenever they want because they don't seek a decisive battle.
Yeah.
So turning this around from the perspective of the attacker, you will lose lots of money, lots of population, lots of morale, and with little result, because you can't face this decisive level.
Yeah,
that's a very important point, because the guerrilla will always evade this decisive battle. It's not like in the movies where then the intruder gets driven out at some point in a glorious final fight or something.
Everybody cheers.
Yeah, everybody cheers, and the movie is over.
Yeah,
yeah. It's a long-term plan. It's a long-term fight for the guerrilla, and he will not win at the tactical level. He will always lose at the tactical level in the long run, as long as he doesn't disperse in time.
Yep.
But he will cause casualties. And those casualties can't be justified by the government anymore at some point. Or the government of the opponent will collapse.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a fascinating thing to look at history with the lens of modern conflicts, modern geopolitical situation, to look back at Russia and Afghanistan. I know a lot of people looked at Russia and Afghanistan very differently when America was in Afghanistan. And they're looking at Russian battles in World War II differently now that Russia is in Ukraine again. It is always interesting to do that study.
Yeah. And I also think that many Americans, but also many Europeans, even out of our community, don't really support the Ukraine for the right reasons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that especially as an American, you should see that the Second Amendment is there for a reason.
Yes.
And we talked about this before, that this concept of defense that America has when we're talking about a foreign danger, mm-hmm. those several lines, like the U.S. military, the U.S. National Guard, and the armed citizen, mm-hmm. can be reversed at every time. Because if something different happened, like Sasha said before, for example, the American military supports Ukraine with troops and shifts a major body of troops,
mm-hmm.
yeah, because NATO is still counting on the US. Without the US, NATO won't run.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're going there. Lots of military forces are bound in Ukraine. And let's say, for example, China decides to invade in a classic Red Dawn style scenario, somehow gapping or skipping US air defense, mm-hmm. dropping paratroopers, whatever. You have a lot of airports that can be used, and invading from the inside. And at this point, this defensive system has to be turned around, because the armored citizen will be the one buying time for the National Guard, will be the one buying time for the military. Of course, the armed citizen, it's hard to say, but the armed citizen won't drive out the full invading force in the short run, at least. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they can do it in a long bloody guerrilla war, but why do so if the military can get the time by the armored citizen? And can basically help join forces.
Yes.
If we are talking about a domestic threat, I personally think it's the Second Amendment is a pillar of your system.
Yes.
It's the pillar why you basically have more freedoms and don't get as much nurtured by the government as we in Europe, for example, do.
But therefore you need to train your basic skills.
Yep.
You need to have that. You need to train that, and you need to sustain that. that basic skills like land nav, shooting, how to move in the terrain, and so on and so forth.
Those pillars of defense. And yes, we have to talk about prepared citizens, because in a serious fashion, what we do at Red Bit Tactical, because things are getting serious. At the moment, the world is showing us, or history is showing us, or the present even are showing us again that this stuff is going to happen. And so what to do on a serious level, because a year ago, tactical stuff was a lot of fun and games. It was a lot of CQB, a lot of flat range shooting, and you should still do flat range shooting in CQB, but you need to think at a more realistic and larger scale.
Yes.
That's the essential thing. It's not about now going into full sustainment kit and doing nothing else than sustainment. You need to learn to act as a full fighting force, because a guerrilla war or a militia won't be won by a squad of 12 guys training together as friends.
Yeah.
As simple as this.
And we're seeing that in Ukraine. We're seeing that there are guerrilla forces doing valuable delaying tactics, delaying work. And then we're seeing people who were less organized becoming more organized. And then we're seeing the more organized actual Ukrainian military, the more capable each of those units are, the better they can work together. And that cumulative effect is huge.
It is. And that's a very important topic. People need to go into reading about military history and military command, military leadership. It's really important to do so, how a fighting force works. And we talked about this during lunch today. And I personally think that those that prepare for serious things today are a bit ahead of their time. And those guys will not be the assaulter in a breaching team or whatever, or in a CQB unit. Those guys will basically be the leaders of sections, of squads, of guerrilla platoons. And that's an important factor. You will train your neighbors. You will train people that are coming to you because you are that guy that got into stuff like this. Yeah. And of course, you will forge their individual skills like shooting, but you also will organize them as a unit.
Yeah.
And that's a really important factor that got skipped in a long way in the tactical community.
Yeah. And not only do I feel kind of humbled when I fail your Instagram quizzes, but as you were talking about different historical battles, lessons learned from historical campaigns, I was again feeling like I had read about this. I didn't actually try to extract a lesson from it, but I have read about this battle, and you have takeaways, lessons that must be learned from these different things. And I know that this is true of Americans in general, not just civilians, but also a number of folks who have actually seen combat. We think of war differently because it hasn't happened at home.
Yeah.
We've never seen anything like what's currently happening in Ukraine on American soil for 150 years.
Yes.
A defensive war on your own soil with collateral damage. The advantage of knowing your own terrain, but the disadvantage of having to defend it and
seeing it in the defense. Yes.
And also to realize there will be casualties.
Yes.
Casualties on your side, casualties on the other side, there are casualties in the civilian and in the military side, on the police, on whatever. Yeah. But the big advantage is you are fighting for your homeland. You are fighting for your family, for your neighborhood, for your community.
Okay.
This is for your moral. Yeah. And this is your motivation.
Yeah.
This is what drives you to give your best. That's basically it.
Yeah. Now, I would like to recommend that everybody who's listening to the podcast, the best way to follow you, in my opinion, is the Instagram stories. You have the best Instagram stories.
Oh, thanks.
Of anyone on Instagram. And I know that doesn't sound like very high praise, because Instagram stories are always useless. But you have useful Instagram stories.
We have useful, useless in the sea.
Yeah. You even make Instagram useful. And then the Patreon The Patreon content is excellent as well. Subscribers get PDF files of the information that is in the Instagram stories. Yeah. So they're easier to read, easier to save, easier to print, easier to refer to. So everybody should look up redbeardtactical.de. So everybody should be following that. And could I request book lists? Some of the books that you were talking about, some of the books that you recommend that listeners learn more about leadership, military structure.
We already have one in our story highlights.
Okay.
Actually, I'm currently extending it.
Excellent. Okay.
Yeah.
Are these books all in English, primarily?
All in English.
Okay.
All in English.
I really appreciate the time that you guys have taken in coming out here. Some of the secret projects that we're working on. Some of the political conversations that can't even go onto the podcast, let alone YouTube videos. And I do really appreciate the work that you guys are doing. So for everyone who's listening, make sure that you go check out redbeardtactical.de.
That's the Instagram. Okay. And our website is redbeardtactical.com. So in the regular internet, we're international.
Okay, fantastic. Well, I'll put the links in the show notes. I will now turn off the recorder so we can talk about really interesting things. Sorry, podcast listeners. We'll figure out how to take care of this sort of thing in the future.
Thank you.